what we're gonna do tonight, somewhat similar, parallel to what I tried to do on Thursday night. I tried to take you through a kind of brief introduction to third-party beneficiary contracts. You could see a little bit of the history of third-party beneficiary contracts and a little bit of where we are now. I'm gonna try and do the same thing with the rules about assignment of contract, which of course also involves three parties. That much they have in common, and by the time we're finished this evening, I'll try and show you some crossovers where you get involved in third-party beneficiary contracts emerging out of an assignment relationship. So it looks a little like this. We're going to assume that there is a contract between A. I'm sorry, this belongs to A over here. He's A, he's B, and he's C. There's a contract that exists between A and C. And we're calling A at the moment becomes the assignor. He is assigning something about this contract he has with C to B. And we're going to talk about what kinds of things he might be assigning. And that brings us to the sort of second nomenclature problem. There can be two aspects of the existing contract between A and C, which may be transferred over to B, and I'll use the word assigned to B. On the one hand, in this contract between A and C, let's say that the contract was A is going to mow C's lawn, and C is going to pay A. C is going to mow A's lawn, and A is going to pay C. Well, if I needed to describe what that contract means to A, so let's do it this way. Try and decide which one's going to be easier for you. Let's do the easy one first. Let's suppose that A is to mow C's lawn. C is to pay money to A. A now says to B, I hereby transfer to you, and we use the word assign to you, I hereby assign to you the payment that C owes me. Now, with respect to the relationship between A and C, if I put this in terms of rights and liabilities, obviously you know there has to be consideration, so it's going in both directions. But with respect to the money, what A has is he has a right to collect the money. He doesn't have a duty to take that money. If he decides that he doesn't want the money, he doesn't have to take it. But he has the right to the money. So what he's doing is he is assigning a right to B. He's saying, the rights that I have against C for money, I hereby assign to you. Now, if you stop and think about that, you'd say to yourself, you know, why should C care? And the answer is C doesn't care. Paying money is paying money. It doesn't hurt any more to pay the money to B than it hurt to pay the money to A. It's exactly the same. And so emerging from that was a rule at common law that by default, all rights are assigned. Now, when I say by default, I mean that. I mean that if the contract between A and C says that there shall be no assignment of rights or delegation of duties, that's the magic phrase, you'll see why in a minute. There shall be no assignment of rights or delegation of duty, well then, this attempt on A's part to assign to B the right to the money that C has to pay, that would not be a valid assignment. It would not be permitted by the contract. But if the contract is silent with respect to assignment, and the common law court looked at that and would say, well, what he's doing is he's assigning a right, and rights are inherently assignable. There are some exceptions, but as a general rule. Now let me turn this around for just a second though. And let's suppose that it really is going the other way. That is that C has a contract to mow, and A has to pay for the mower. Now, if A attempts to transfer to B the duty that C has to mow A's lawn, that raises a different kind of problem. If the contract simply says you have the obligation to mow and doesn't say what lawn, and if we assume that A has a plot of land that's roughly, a backyard that's roughly 20 by 20, but B has a lawn that's roughly 2 acres, it's a decidedly different kind of job. It may be that when we turned it around before, all C had an obligation to do was to pay money, but C really wouldn't care whether he was paying the money to A or B. But he may very well care. He may care. It is more probable that he could care whether he's performing this function that he has to do. And this, of course, is a duty. Under the contract, he has a duty to mow the lawn. And so this is a transfer of a duty. And with respect to duties, the common law was much more concerned about whether or not they were assignable or not. Indeed, even today, though this law has changed over time, so I'll try to show you, the courts are much more likely to scrutinize an assignment which involves, and they use the word delegation. It's easy to remember because they both start with the letter D. They use the word delegation of duties to distinguish this assignment of rights. So now we discover that although the general law is called the law of assignment, the courts in fact distinguish two different possibilities for what you're assigning. On the one hand, it could be an assignment of right. That's generally okay unless the contract says no or except in special circumstances. But when it comes to duties, if what you're doing is trying to transfer a duty that you have, there, and it's called a delegation of the duty, there the court is more likely to scrutinize it with care. Now, what are they looking for? Because they're really going to look for the same thing in both cases. What the court cares about is, well, on the one hand, you didn't say anything in the contract that our general rule is that assignments are the default rule. You can assign. On the other hand, our job, after all, is to carry out the intention of the parties. We've said that how many times during the course of the year. And what if this decidedly changes the nature of the contract? It really does change the nature of the contract. So we can see a court wrestling with this question. Look at Evening News Association versus Peterson. Here we have a TV anchor. TV anchor works for one company that owns a TV station, host Newsweek stations. They sell out to something called the Evening News Association. And when they sell out to them, they engage in an act of assignment. And you can find the language of assignment on top page 861. PNS, that's Post Newsweek, has granted, bargained, sold, conveyed, and assigned to the Evening News Association all the property of Post new Newsweek stations, including all rights, title, and interest, legal or equitable, of PNS into and under all agreements, contracts, and commitments listed in Schedule A here too. And guess what? In Schedule A, one of them is the contract that they have with Peterson. After all, they're selling a TV station. They don't have any use for Peterson because they don't have a TV station, and he's a TV anchor. So, well, what is this? This is an assignment. So one thing that we could ask, given what I've said is the typical way that courts analyze these, is, well, let's see, am I talking about an assignment of rights or a delegation of duties, or am I talking about both? What is it that this contract with between Post News and Evening News, Post Newsweek and Evening News, what is it that they are transferring to the buyer of the TV station with respect to our friend Peterson? I mean, the easy answer would be his contract, I know, but if I had to describe this as rights and duties, Becca?
Sure. Isn't he has to continue to be the news anchor, the new owner?
Right, and what is that? Is that a right or a duty?
I would say it's a duty only because it's analogous to mowing the lawn, to performing.
But what do they have with respect to Peterson?
Sorry? Well, they have a...
They have a duty, all right, but is the duty anything to do with what he has to do? What's their duty? Let's start with the duty.
Their duty is to pay him.
Yeah, their duty is to pay him. That's right. And what right have they?
To receive the service.
Absolutely. So they are engaged in an assignment which, from their point of view, involves both of these, right? The duty here is the duty to pay. And the right is a right to receive services. Now, of course, you understand that always corresponding to the right, there's a duty. Corresponding to the duty, there's a right. That's the way it works. So what's Peterson's objection here? And while the court doesn't ultimately agree with Peterson, they certainly do, you know, treat carefully his comments.
Basically doesn't like his new bosses. He felt he had a better relationship and a more input in the old situation, so he felt that kind of materially changed his job.
Right. He's saying that he's tried it out now for a period of 7 or 8 months, and along the way, they managed to fire the producer for the show. And so now the whole staff that he deals with are the new staff from Evening News. And he's not happy. And he tries to give some flesh to that, and the court says, poo-poos it. You know, he tries to say, well, I'm not sent out as often on assignment. And so they show that he's sent out just as often on assignment. But he is not happy. What do you gather that he would have had to show? After all, incidentally, when you talked about that, and we think about this issue of duties and rights, is he complaining about the delegation to them of the duty to pay him? He's not. He's not. Because in this case, he doesn't really care who pays him. That's of no importance at all. So what he's complaining about is actually the assignment of the right to call on his services, the right to require his services. If we talked about what they have done in their assignment, what the assignment is, the assignment involves a delegation of the duty to pay and an assignment of the right to receive services. Here, he's actually complaining about that assignment of rights. He's saying that's not assignable. What do you gather from the way the court discusses it? He loses. What do you gather from the way the court discusses it? He would have to show in order to win, because he certainly lost here. Yeah,
he would have had to show that their unique relationship, yeah, personal relationship, that the services were unique and unusual. And when they looked at his employment contract, basically it was just a typical employment contract for a news anchor. So there was nothing that he was doing that was unique versus his new bosses. He just wasn't happy. And he didn't show anything different. He didn't show that there was anything unusual or unique about what he did for his old bosses.
Now, if you think about that for a minute, is this way of approaching the interpretation of a contract the appropriate way? What does it omit? The court goes back to the contract. Absolutely, you've said it absolutely correctly. The court goes back and it looks at the contract he signed, and it doesn't say anything about who's going to be his producer. It doesn't say anything about how many times he's going to be sent out on assignment. It doesn't say any of that. It only says, you know, you'll appear a certain number of hours doing news anchor work. And indeed, as far as we can tell, he has the same schedule for the news station as he had for the old. What's missing?
It's almost kind of like they're excluding parole evidence that, oral discussions.
Hold on, watch the way you use those words. Parole evidence, are we going to go back to what time? A time before the contract was signed?
No, it's actually after.
Yeah, so it's not parole evidence.
Course of performance?
Ah, now you got it. Or we technically, if we were under the UCC, which we're not because it's a service contract, we would call this course of performance. Right? Course of dealing is where there are prior contracts of the same kind, and there may be some course of dealing here. We don't know the sequence of his earlier contracts, but there's certainly a course of performance. Now, the court does look a little bit at that. For example, when they look to see how many times was he sent out on assignment, that's looking at course of performance. So the court looks at some, but they don't look at another aspect of course of performance, which is the human interrelationship that he had in connection with the production of the show. Now, maybe they were right, maybe they were wrong, but when we've talked about interpretation of contracts, we've certainly talked about an understanding of what a contract means, partly by how it's performed. In any event, the court says, well, we're going to look, and Becca had it absolutely right, we're going to look to see whether there was anything particularly unique, particularly personal, and that these things would have to have been written into the contract, or at least be very evident to us that somehow or another the nature of his job had profoundly changed, had materially changed in the assignment, in the purchase of the station, in the assignment of his contract, and we don't see it, so it's okay. So, this case tells us a couple of things. It tells us that assignment of right can sometimes be as troublesome to the non-assigning party as a delegation of duty. It can be. And that the nature of the question is always really going to be the same. That is, how has it impacted the non-assigning party? That's what we're really concerned about. This is the non-assigning party. And the question is, how does this assignment from A to B, whether it's an assignment of right or delegation of duties, but particularly, historically, particularly if it's delegation of duties, how does it affect the contractual position that C had, the non-assigning party, that he had in the agreement between A and C, the original contract that's being assigned? So, another aspect of the, now let's stay with that aspect for a second. I'm gonna skip over a note and then we're gonna come back to it. Let's look at Mackey versus Pizza of Gaithersburg, right? Remember, that's the case in which Pizza of Gaithersburg Inc. got a bunch of pizza parlors, and they have machines to sell sodas, other drinks, and they have a contract with an outfit called Virginia to provide that service. And they, let's say, roughly split the profits to be made from these machines. And we know, because the court tells us this, that before they signed the contract with Virginia, they had interviewed a whole bunch of companies and had some associations with other companies, including Mack Company. But they really liked Virginia. They thought that Virginia did an especially good job servicing the machines. So they make the contract with Virginia, and unfortunately for them, not too many years after that, about a year after it, Virginia sells out to guess who? To Mack. And when they sell out to Mack, they, of course, assign all of the contracts in their, well, call it their portfolio. After all, their business is just a series of contracts with people like Pizza of Gaithersburg to do this same thing, place machines, maintain the machines, fill the machines, and split the profits in some fashion. They didn't like Mack. They purposely went to Virginia because they didn't like Mack. They didn't think that he maintained the machines as well. But now the contract that he had with Virginia now belongs to Mack, at least in the agreement between Virginia and Mack, in which Virginia sold out all of its assets, one of them being this contract, was assigned. And again, we're going to assume a general assignment, an assignment of rights, a delegation of duties. They complain. They say, no, we're not going to keep this contract. So Pizza of Gaithersburg said to Mack, take your machines out, don't darken my door. And Mack says, you can't do that, that's a breach of contract. What contract? Well, the contract that we got by assignment from Virginia. Now, if I have to break this down again into assignment, right, and delegation duty, which I do have to, what has been assigned, what has been delegated? From Virginia to Mack. After all, they're the two parties to the assignment. Virginia is the assignor, Mack is the assignee. Our friend Pizza of Gaithersburg, they are the non-assigning party of this contract that's been assigned.
Mack is assigned to Virginia the duty to service the equipment, and they're giving them, they're assigning them the right to collect profits.
Exactly. Right. The delegation of duty, the duty to maintain the machines in Pizza of Gaithersburg's pizza parlors, and the assignment of the right to collect money from them. What is the non-assigning party Pizza of Gaithersburg complaining about here? The assignment of right or the delegation of duty? Do they care whether they're paying Virginia or paying Mack? What do they care about?
The delegation of duty.
Yeah. Yeah, they're complaining about the delegation of duty. The duty is a duty to maintain, to place the machines, fill the machines, maintain the machines. It's that duty that's been delegated, and they are complaining about the delegation. Now, what's the nature of their complaint? Are they coming in to show that Mack is incapable of doing it? Are they coming in to show that Mack has failed to maintain them?
I think just that they don't want him. They interviewed him before and didn't pick him and don't want him.
They don't want him. They don't want them in their pizza parlors. And the court responds very sympathetically, right? No.
No.
No. Not at all. They say, too bad you got them. Because after all, your contract with Virginia, they don't say this, but I'll say it, your contract with Virginia did not have a no assignment clause. And without that, contemporary law says rights are assignable and duties are delegatable. It's interesting, 25 years, 30 years, 40 years before this decision was made, the court would have made a distinction between these two and said, wait a second, it's perfectly easy to assign the right, that's no problem for us, but this duty that's being delegated, we have to ask the question of whether it in any way gave to the non-assigning party less than they legitimately expected to have from the contract that's now been assigned. But you notice that this court, it would have taken much more than that complaint. It did take much more than that complaint, and all he had was a complaint. Now, you can see as a contrast with that, I know I'm skipping a few, but I'll come back. Look at Sally Beauty versus Nexus Products Company. That's the case on page 871. We are in a very short time tonight. I'm going to get through this wonderfully. Take a look at Sally. That's not my doing. It's the casebook's doing. What was the nature of the complaint that Nexus Products had when there was an assignment by Best Barber and Beauty Supply Company to Sally Beauty Company? And what they assigned, of course, was the contract that Nexus had with Best. Okay, you're going to be right, but I'm going to make you step back for a second. If we had to do this by talking about this again as assignment of right and delegation of duty, which are they complaining about here?
The duty.
Again, a delegation of duty. So this is like Mac versus the pizza case. Okay. And what was it again about Nexus that they were complaining about?
Well, Nexus, who picked up the duty to sell their products, was actually their competitor. So Nexus, when they originally did the contract, the person was supposed to perform good faith in selling the products, and when they sold it to their competitor, they didn't feel that they were performing in good faith to sell the product anymore because it was against their best interest.
And this is a sale of goods
yes.
contract, and it was an exclusive sale of goods contract. And so what's the rule? Even if the contract didn't say, what obligations would Best have, and therefore would Nexus have under 23062? Remember? Exclusive, you have, it's exactly what you said before.
Oh, you have to use best faith effort to perform.
Yeah, you have to use your best faith efforts to maximize the value of this contract. In other words, to sell goods. So, what did the court do with this one? After all, they're really saying, gee, we just don't like Sally Beauty, but they have a specific reason, namely that Sally Beauty was a competitor, right?
So they had moved for summary judgment, and the court granted it.
So here, this works and they win, because they managed to persuade the court that the delegation of duty here did profoundly, materially affect the value of the contract to them. That is what they could legitimately expect from this assignee compared to what they expected from the assignor, who was, after all, the party with whom they contracted. See, it's always looked at from the point of view of the non-assigning party. And you're always asking the same question. How does this affect the non-assigning party? And what these two cases tell you back to back is that even if it's a delegation of duty, the court is likely to say it's okay unless you can show that it does materially adversely affect you or is likely to. Otherwise, you don't get to do it. Now, there's a few other aspects of assignment that the authors ask you to look at. Look at Kendall versus Ernest Pestana, Inc. It's a California case, 1985. This is a problem which there's just a slew of litigation. This happens to have been a lessor-lessee relationship, and they do frequently but not exclusively arise in this context. What was the problem here? What was the language in the contract that creates the issue, and then what happened? Contract between the lessor and the lessee, right? What does the lessee want to do? What's the lessee want to do in here? Well, it's in a chapter on assignment. That should give you a pretty good clue about what the lessee wants to do.
Sublet.
That's a sublet. Subletting is a form of assignment, okay? You are assigning the lease that you have to someone else. And what did the lease say? Here there is some language in the contract between the lessor and lessee on the subject of assignment.
The provision said that the lessee may not sublet without written consent by the lessor.
Right. So it's not a rule in the contract against assignment. It doesn't say under no circumstances may the lessee assign the lease. But it says they may not assign the lease without the written consent of the non-assigning party, here the lessor. And the court is prepared to sustain that provision. It's a perfectly valid provision, but the lessee complains that there was no good reason for the lessor to refuse to agree. And the lessor says, the contract gives me the absolute right. That's what the contract says. That's what the lease says. It says that you can't assign it unless I agree to the assignment, and I don't agree to the assignment. That's the end of it. And what does the court say?
They say that they can't do that unless it's reasonable. You can't just unreasonably, arbitrarily say, oh, no, I won't agree with it. You have to have a good reason.
Where does that rule come from? If you had to sort of classify its sources, what is that like?
It says that it's sort of a common law. It's a trend. It's the majority switching to a minority.
It is. That's true. But it's an aspect of what particular interest that the legal system has, or the rules of the game that the legal system has. Yes. It's another example of the emergence of this pervasive doctrine of good faith. Notice, not in the negotiation of an agreement, right, but in the performance of an agreement. Because remember, the act of assignment, we're not forming, you're forming this assignment, but it's the relationship between the lessor and lessee is an ongoing contractual relationship. And it requires that both parties to that relationship behave in good faith. This is simply one example, one specific kind of example of, and yes, it is emergent. That's correct. We see more and more of it. Just the same way as throughout the year we've seen more and more emphasis on protection of reliance, we've seen more and more emphasis on the insistence on performance of good faith. I hope that you see those two. They are the two most dramatic, two most important developments in contract law in the last 50 or 75 years. And they haven't stopped yet. That is, their growth continues. Their significance in refashioning contract law continues. Okay, so that's Kendall versus Ernest Pistone. And one other issue, I think, and then we can talk, take questions real. One other issue, and that is, what happens when we say that in fact something has been assigned and something's been assigned successfully? What does that mean to the assignor? After all, the assignor has some kind of obligation. Right now, here in this my last diagram, and we'll stay with this, the assignor had to pay money to C. And this contract was both an assignment of right and a delegation of duty. So therefore, that means that the duty that A had to pay C has now been delegated to B, and therefore B has, apparently, an obligation to pay C. Let's suppose for a moment that B does not pay C. Can C bring an action against A? And I'm assuming that this is, the court has already decided, if it has to, that this is a perfectly appropriate assignment of rights and delegation of duties. It's a done deal. B does really have an obligation to, in this case, pay money, but he hasn't done it.
Say yes, they do. The original assigner does still have to, is still liable for that debt.
Exactly. A can delegate the performance obligation to B, but A can't rid himself of the legal obligation that he has. Now, next question. Then you get the answer to that. So A, there is a way, by the way, in which this could change, and it has a nice technical meaning, technical word. The word is novation. I'm not sure you've ever heard that word before. Novation. Let's suppose that A now comes to C and says to C, you know something, I have now delegated, I've assigned the contract completely over to B. So I've done an assignment of right and delegation of duty, so you know, I'm not going to be paying you that money anymore. And C says, okay, that's perfectly okay with me. That is called a novation. And the result of the novation is that now only B owes C, A does not anymore. But you notice what happened is that C had to agree to it. Nothing that A does unilaterally, or nothing that A does together with B, can change the fact that A owes that money to C. Now obviously what happens procedurally is that C brings an action against A is going to institute third-party action against B, because he's going to say, no, I'm not the one who really owes the money. If I have to pay, you have to pay me. Next question. Okay, forget the novation. Hold on, this next point doesn't matter whether it is or not. Let's suppose now that C knows that A has made the assignment to B, so C wants to bring an action against B, saying, where's my money? Is there any problem about C bringing the action against B? I think you were using the word last time. No,
oh,
last class maybe?
Oh, last class.
Privity.
Oh, privity.
Privity, remember that? Privity, no privity. There's no contractual relationship between C and B. They've never seen each other before. Now here, obviously, wait a second. Why can't we argue that when B accepts the assignment, B is in effect promising A that B will pay C? What does that sound like?
Third party.
Exactly. That sounds like C is arguing, I am an intended third-party beneficiary of the agreement between A and B. Now here, we have a distinct difference among our various courts and various bodies of law. The Uniform Commercial Code says yes, right? C can sue B. The restatement says yes, C can sue B. Probably about half American jurisdictions, or maybe a little more than half, say, well, not so fast. C can bring an action against B if B articulates in the assignment a promise to pay B, but not otherwise. So even though, as a matter of law, when B takes on this assignment from A, B is legally obligated to pay C, and if he doesn't, and if C brings an action against A can sue B for breach of contract because their contract requires B to carry out A's duties because they were delegated to B. B accepted that delegation along with the assignment of right. But half the American jurisdictions say, only if he says, and A, you'll be happy to know, that I promise to pay B, that is, I promise to perform my contractual obligation to B, only then will they find that C is a third-party beneficiary, an intended third-party beneficiary. Otherwise, they'll decide that he's an incidental third-party beneficiary. That's just plain wrong, and it'll change over time. As I say, the Uniform Commercial Code makes it clear now that C can bring an action against B. The restatement of contracts says C can bring an action against B. But there is still some old law that he can't. It doesn't reflect a kind of narrowing of the rules of assignment. What it does is to reflect the traditional reluctance to recognize third-party beneficiary contracts. And this is just a little remnant of that reluctance to recognize third-party beneficiary contracts. By the way, in the discussion of that in the case book, I should point out to you, on page 874, the last paragraph that I asked you to read for tonight starts this interpretation of the type 2 transactions adopted in both restatement second, section 328, and UCC 2-. And if you went looking for it, you'd realize that that's not 310-2, that's 210-2. The provision on assignment is 2-210, not 2-310, which deals with an entirely different subject in which we have probably very, very little interest. So, what do we gain from all of this? There are two circumstances in which assignment occurs very frequently. We've only really looked at one of them, and there's some reasons for that, but I want to tell you about both. The one we've looked at is when there's corporate mergers. Right? A typical aspect of businesses selling out to other businesses has to do with this kind of assignment. By the way, keep Peterson in mind if you are a lawyer practicing law, you represent somebody and negotiating a personnel contract. Keep in mind the lessons you've learned from Peterson. That is, if you learn from your client that it's intensely important to your client what those human relations are, then you want to put a provision limiting the assignability of that contract in some fashion. You might want to negotiate for no assignment clause at all, or rather a negation of the right to assign. That may not be negotiable. But keep in mind that if you are silent about it, your client's fate is likely to be Peterson's fate. And the burdens of trying to defeat the effect of that assignment may be too great for you to overcome and for your client to overcome. So this is one area where assignment is very, very, very common. The other, yeah.
If you put in a no assignment clause, when I looked at the case where it says it's unless it's unreasonable and arbitrary, you know what I mean? So how do you combat that? What do you put in there? Because
well,
you just put a general assignment.
Yeah, you have to actually say that the parties agree that there shall be neither an assignment of rights nor delegation of duties created by this contract. And most courts will give effect to that. If you say there shall be no assignment of right, the court will read that as though it said there shall be no delegation of duties, and they will go ahead and allow an assignment of rights. So don't just say no assignment. That won't work. You have to say no assignment of rights and no delegation of duties. Doesn't always work, but most courts will give effect to it. The other area in which the law of assignment is extremely important, and you'll learn much more about this if you take the course in Article 9, which is called Secure Transactions, is as a financing device. Let's suppose that you buy a car and you borrow money to buy the car. Now, there are various ways in which these transactions are done, but the predominant way is that you buy the car and there is then an assignment by you of the right to repossess the car to the person who's financing your acquisition of the car. That's covered by Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code about how that gets done and what the rules are that pertains to it. Oh yeah, a third area, very important in the practice of law, is assigning claims. That is, that A has a claim against B of some kind or another. Can A assign that claim? So A is driving along and B runs into A's car. A has a claim against B. Can A assign that claim? Answer, yes. Claims are assignable. All kinds of rights that you have are all assignable, not just contract rights. So the law of assignment is actually very broad. It covers a myriad of transactions. What I wanted to focus on with you right now is the transaction as you most frequently see it, where the original right and duty are created by contract, and one of the parties decides to assign the right and delegate the duties created by that contract to somebody else, and the non-assigning party is unhappy about it. What can they do about it? The lesson for the evening is not much, unless they can show that they are materially adversely affected by the transaction. Some of these cases are very, very easy, right? So if I have a contract with a famous artist to paint my portrait, they cannot delegate it to their favorite student. They can't assign that contract. If I have a concert hall and I have hired a famous pianist to play a concert for me, they cannot assign that contract to another pianist. So any contract which is regarded as being particularly personal, that is inhering in the person or some particular ability of the person or entity, that is likely to be found to be not assignable, or at least that the duties will not be delegatable. Remember, that pianist who I have a contract with can't delegate to another pianist the contract to play in my hall, but they can assign to a bank the right to collect the fee that I have to pay under that contract. An example of an instance in which that pianist with whom I have a contract can easily assign the right to somebody else, but cannot delegate the duty. Everybody understand how this works? You have to say it to yourself 5 or 6 or 10 or 12 times, and after a while, it'll begin to make some sense. But underlying it all is a perfectly understandable human impulse. Human impulse is to concern yourself with the non-assigning party. How does it affect the non-assigning party? Very little, the assignment is good. A very lot, adversely, the assignment and delegation are probably bad. Something in between goes to the jury, if there's a jury trial, and each side tries to make the case. The aggrieved non-assigning party tries to make the case of how adversely affected they are, but you can see what happened to Mr. Peterson. Didn't work. Questions? If any. I've read now about, I think, 12 or 13 practice exams. And I would say, based on them, that there are two things that I would like you to focus on. But they're really, in a way, the same. More than anything else, what's missing is the ability to clearly state the legal rule that you are applying. You've got to, if you can't do that, if you can't take each of the rules that we've talked about during the course here, and I know there are scores and scores of them, I realize that, but if you can't take each one and say what the elements of the rule are, you can't really write a good law school examination, at least not for me, you can't. If you take a look at the way in which the judges write these opinions, you will see that the judge always states the rule and then shows how they believe the rule applies to the facts. Now, you can say, okay, that's just a bad habit that lawyers have, and maybe it is, but these are necessary components of any persuasive argument of any kind. Unless you have more faith and trust in my judgment about movies than you should have, if I said to you, I saw a movie last Saturday night, it was really great, you should feel, you should know, I should know, that I have said nothing that was persuasive. I expressed an opinion, but there's nothing about it that's persuasive. What could I say to make it more persuasive? Well, I could say, after all, in the end, what counts in a movie is character development. And in this movie, here is this protagonist, what he's like at the beginning of the movie, and look at what has happened to them, how that person has evolved, has developed till the end. Now, there are two possibilities. Number one is you could say, well, I'd like to see that movie. That is, I've persuaded you because I've stated a rule. That is, the rule is that character development is the hallmark of a good film, and then I've described how it applied to the facts and how the film meets that criteria. Or you might have a different reaction. You might say to me, yeah, but how much action is there? Or how good were the special effects? And I'd say, well, there weren't any special effects at all. I'd say, well, I'm not the least bit interested. Now there, what's happened is we've disagreed about the rule. We can then get into a discussion about which rule is the better rule. There won't be a positive outcome of that discussion, probably, from either of our points of view, but we could talk about it. But without having as components the rule, the basis in which you're making a judgment, you're going to reach a conclusion, without having that set out, you don't have a legal argument. And what that requires is the ability beforehand to say to yourself, can I say it? So when you quote review, one of the ways of testing yourself in review is look up from the book or the paper or whatever, typewriter, whatever keyboard, whatever you're working with, and say, let's see, I've just been reading the parole evidence rule. My head is going round and round. Can I say what the parole evidence rule is? When does it apply and what does it do? And yet, say it, Don't just say, oh yeah, I can. No, no, say it. Because that's what you're gonna need when you sit down. And you don't wanna have to wrestle with that part of it when you sit there. You wrestle with the analytic part, which rules are going to apply. But once you decide which rules are gonna apply, the rest should come mechanically to you, pretty much automatically. You know, and have the phrasing ready to go. The more precisely you have it, the better the answer you'll write. But when you do that, don't stop there. Then you have to show, well, which facts support it? So somebody says, well, clearly the contract is enforceable because there's a promise enforceable because he detrimentally relied. And justice requires it. Oh, good. Except you haven't told me how. What in the facts represent that reliance? Why in the facts was it foreseeable? Right? Because if you don't do that, then what you've done is you've made a splendid statement of the rule, but you haven't made a persuasive argument because you haven't showed me how that rule applies to the facts. You put together an exam which has the rule and those facts, and you will write a good exam. You don't, your exam, I'm not saying it's going to fail. Of course, it's not going to fail. You've learned something. You'll show it. But it's not going to be everything you want it to be. It's not going to be what you can make it. But it requires you to be prepared to do it methodically, to have the discipline to do it. That's what it is. A lot of this is intellectual discipline. Say to yourself, that's what I have to do. I'm in a hurry, I'm anxious, I just want to break through it. You can't do that. Better to write less, but to write better. If you're challenged to do it in terms of time, then say fewer words. Here's the thing about it. If you've prepared yourself with a good, crisp statement of the rule, and then you discipline yourself to show how it applied to a particular fact, you won't have to say it three times. You'll save yourself time that way. You don't have to write a long essay about each question that's raised. It could be focused. You'll do better. It's also less reading for me, but I... In my grading, I don't give you credit for length. I don't take points off for length, but I don't give you credit for length. So writing a 2-page essay can frequently be better than a 5-page essay. It just depends upon what words you say. It's worthwhile taking the time to make sure that you're saying it precisely as you can. Remember that on, I'm going to stop now, but remember that on Wednesday night, God help us, at 8 o'clock, I wanted to review. I'll do a review, but it will be much more useful if you send me questions as precise as you can. If they're general, they're general, sort of pointing me toward things that you would particularly like to hear one more time. Otherwise, I'm just going to take it kind of from the beginning. We've covered a lot of material all year. And so there's a lot of stuff there that we're going to possibly examine on. As you know from the full exam, the exam's not going to cover everything we talked about. It covers a tiny fraction of what we talked about. So your burden is to learn it all and be prepared to know that you're not going to be able to show it all. But you will be able to show, I hope, that you thought about this, that you have an understanding of it, and it's not just an abstract understanding, it's also an ability to see how it applies to the facts that you're given. What am I applying, and how do I apply it? So you can send them in the forum, it's fine. You can send me email, it's fine. If you're going to send me email, you do yourself and me a favor. If you'll use the contact form that I have up on the website, the reason for that is only it then goes into a special folder, and therefore I won't miss it. I get a lot of mail. And if it doesn't get deposited automatically in that folder, I try to scan all my mail, but at this point, I fall behind, and I'm way behind reading mail at this point. So if you use that form, it goes in the special folder for you, for contracts class, for section 3, and I won't miss it. Okay, good luck, and I'll see you Wednesday.